Welcome to Nocturnal Tales. Tonight we step into Albemarle Hall, where the glitter of masks and music hides something far more dangerous. Lady Lavinia Sefton has summoned Hercule Poirot and Captain Hastings to a charity mask. But beneath the lanterns and velvet costumes lies a secret note, a midnight threat, and a guest of honor whose very life may be at stake. This is a royal masquerade, an original tale inspired by the assassination of King Gustav III of Sweden in 1792, a crime of politics and theater, retold here in homage to the genius of Agatha Christie, yet woven in our own words. Before we begin, tell us in the comments, where in the world are you listening from tonight? From quiet English villages to cities across the globe, we love seeing where these mysteries travel. Producing these stories, writing, narrating, illustrating, takes many hours, and your support is what allows us to keep creating them at the standard you enjoy. If you'd like to help, you can join our membership for ad-free listening and exclusive tales, or leave a small tip. And if that's not possible, know that your listening, your comments, and your shares are already a valued gift that keeps Nocturnal Tales alive. Now, let the mask begin. Chapter 1. The Mask Begins. If London has a genius, it is for dressing up reality until one no longer knows where truth ends and theatre begins. I have seen statesmen turned to buffoons by a loose domino and a paper crown. I have seen a charwoman made queenly by a scrap of crimson velvet and a borrowed tiara. That was why, when the affair of Albemarle Hall began, on a mild October evening in the late 20s, I was prepared for almost anything, except perhaps the thing that actually happened. We were at Whitehaven Mansions, and Poirot was presiding over his breakfast tray with the fastidious pleasure he reserves for geometry and food. He had formed the bread and butter into two precise triangles, and was considering whether the pot of jam looked happier on the left or the right. "Order, Hastings," he murmured, shifting it by a hair's breadth. "One may forgive the English their weather, but not their asymmetry." I was about to defend my countrymen when the lift clanked and the unmistakable sweep of a fashionable skirt rustled down the corridor. A moment later, Miss Lenoir, Lady Lavinia Sefton's confidential maid, who had announced herself stiffly at the door, presented a thick, cream-colored envelope on a salver as if it were the tiara of Russia. "For Monsieur Poirot," she said. "Her ladyship begs that you open it at once." Poirot broke the seal delicately. Two sheets slipped out. The first, a formal card engraved, "Lady Lavinia Sefton requests the pleasure of the company of Monsieur Hercule Poirot and Captain Arthur Hastings at a masque in aid of the St. Cyprian's Fund, Albemarle Hall. Friday the 24th, 11 o'clock until 2. The second was a single line, scrawled in pencil with theatrical flourish. At the stroke of midnight, the masque will end in truth." Poirot held the card between finger and thumb as though it might bruise. "A joke?" I ventured. He pointed to a faint smear at the lower margin. "Not a joke, mon ami. Grease. A trace of spirit gum, I think. The hand that wrote this has lately affixed a false mustache, or at least some disguise." "Spirit gum? How can you tell?" "Because, Hastings, I am not the only person in London who thinks the face is improved by artifices." He tapped his own luxuriant moustaches with modest vanity. Then, more gravely, "Lady Lavinia will have received others. She is a woman who sends for Hercule Poirot, not for parlour tricks." Miss Lenoir confirmed it. "Three notes, sir. Anonymous, each more unpleasant. Her ladyship is very much put about. The guest of honour—" Here she stopped, as ladies' maids are bred to do, on the brink of indiscretion. Poirot's eyes kindled. "The guest of honour, who is he?" Miss Lenoir hesitated. "Her ladyship begs that you come in person. There are political considerations."
"Ah,
Poirot's forefinger rose. "Then we will go. But discreetly, if you please." "Costume?" I asked, taken at once with the boyish prospect of masks and music. "Certainly costume," said Poirot with an air of resigned martyrdom, "but simple. A black domino, perhaps. It has the advantage that it hides little and reveals much." "That is not how I should have put it," I said, laughing, and declared myself for Harlequin. "It is a part that flatters a man who is no longer 25. The diamonds are slimming, if you arrange them judiciously." Albemarle Hall glowed that night like a slice of fairyland dropped among the stern facades of Mayfair. Lamps swayed along the railings like moons in frolic. The great stone lions wore wreaths of ivy and black satin masks. Inside, the ballroom had been transformed into a Venetian square, with painted balconies and little bridges arching over nothing in particular. The band, hidden behind a screen painted to represent a canal, sent out a froth of jazz that bubbled against the marble. A footman, discreetly powdered, took our cloaks. I saw my reflection multiplied in a row of gilt mirrors. A gentleman adventurer in a motley of black and white. Behind me, Poirot, precise even in anonymity, his black domino falling in impeccable lines, his mask set at an angle that suggested seriousness rather than mystery. His shoes, I noticed, shone like wet ink. "Mon cher discretion," he admonished me, as I executed a small caper in time to the music. "You are Harlequin, yes, but you will not steal the spoons." Lady Lavinia, in a queen's ruff and a gown of midnight blue, came gliding to us like a ship under full sail. Her eyes were heavily shadowed with kohl, the fashion of the moment, but the anxiety beneath the paint was not fashionable. "Monsieur Poirot, I am so thankful. Captain Hastings." Her hands were cool in mine. "You see these absurdities," she said, waving a jeweled fan at the frolic around us. "If only it were merely play. But I have had the most odious notes and threatening our guest of honour. I applied to the police, naturally, but they are so dreadfully conspicuous at a mask." "Your guest?" Poirot prompted. She lowered her voice. "You will keep this to yourselves. He is here incognito, as the Duke of Alnwick's cousin. But I am not deceived in a cousin who travels with two secretaries, a surgeon, and a valet who calls him Majesty when he forgets himself. He is the sovereign of Scandia, King Edvard. There is to be a state visit later in the year, and the Foreign Office thought a private appearance would do him good." "All this," she indicated the paper lanterns with a tragic little smile, "is for hospitals, you know, and because London adores a king." "Scandia," I murmured. "A pocket kingdom up there somewhere among fjords and fir trees." "Pocket kingdoms have long daggers," said Poirot, "and some of the pockets do not like to be emptied." She handed him the other notes, thin papers creased and refolded. They bore the same theatrical hand. "Do not let him strike 12. A king must bow to the masked ones. Tonight the part he plays will be the last. One was dotted unmistakably with the faintest rust-colored marks." "Blood?" I whispered. "Wax," said Poirot, "from a cheap taper. Someone who writes by candle in a room without proper light. And see, the fold, always the same height. Habit. It is not the work of a romantic schoolboy, Lady Lavinia."
"Then you think..."
"I think," said Poirot, "that midnight in this house will not be merely 12 o'clock. We moved amongst the crowd, our eyes busy. There were kings enough to satisfy even London's appetite. Henry VIII, vast and self-sufficient. A Louis with a flock of marquises tittering behind his fan. An Egyptian pharaoh with a wristwatch. Two Pierrots leaned against a pillar, heads together. A woman in a bat's mask laughed and showed very white teeth. A domino of dull gold, tall, with a swaggering stride that belied the anonymity of his dress, carried a black stick and tapped it against his thigh as if keeping time. I noticed the hand that held it was gloved in grey kid, and that the glove was stained at the cuff by something darker.
Who is that? I asked a passing Columbine. Which? Oh, the Golden Domino, some foreigner, she said with a toss.
Everyone is something tonight. It is the only way we can bear to be ourselves the rest of the week. At 5 minutes to midnight, a ripple ran through the room. The band ceased in the middle of a bar and, as it were, held its breath. The great clock over the gallery, a florid piece with cupids, showed 5:02. On the painted balcony above the masqueraders, a small platform had been erected, draped with crimson. Lady Lavinia's voice, clear and carrying, announced a tableau of allegiance, a nonsense of her devising in which fortune would crown Britannia, and the masked company would cheer to the ceiling. Behind the crimson curtains I fancied I saw movement, the flash of a star sewn on black. The air sharpened. One could feel the hush like silk drawn through the fingers. Poirot's hand, close to mine, hardly stirred, yet I knew every faculty in him was awake and intent, like a fine instrument vibrating to a distant note. The clock began to strike. 1, 2. The figures in the tableau stepped forward, Britannia with her trident, Fortune with a wheel of gilt, an actor dressed as the Law, absurdly bewigged. And last between them, a man in a plain black mask and a mantle sewn with silver stars. He raised a hand slightly, as if to acknowledge a private signal, and the crowd, not knowing whom it applauded, applauded wildly. 10, 11. I became conscious of three small things at once. First, that the Golden Domino, who had stood to my left, was suddenly no longer there. Second, that the bat-masked woman had drawn back into a shadow by the staircase. Third, that a footman near the platform, a new footman, I thought, one I had not noticed earlier, had shifted the tray he carried to his left hand, though he had been using his left already. 12. The last stroke trembled on the air, and with it came a sound which the English ear, trained to gaiety, mistakes at first for the pop of champagne. There was a cry, a woman's, the kind that tears rather than rings. On the balcony, the man in the star-sewn mantle put a hand to his side and swayed. The black mask tilted. For a fraction of a second I saw a white profile, startled, incredulous, and oddly gentle. Then he crumpled to his knees, and the crimson drapery behind him received him like a stage curtain falling. "Bon," said Poirot softly, with no satisfaction, only a narrowing of the eyes. "It begins." And because this is not the theatre, but life, the band, which had been instructed to break into God Save the King at the precise moment, did so, bravely, idiotically, while panic ran round the room like wind in a wheat field, and the paper moon swung and grinned, and a little shower of gilt confetti, released by some clownish mechanism, drifted down to gleam on the dark stains spreading on the crimson cloth. Chapter 2, The Golden Domino. For the space of perhaps half a minute, no one moved. It was the curious stillness that falls sometimes in battle before the charge begins. Then came the rush, the flutter, the cry of frightened women, the cries of, "Doctor! Doctor!" and the ridiculous, persistent throb of the band still hammering away at God Save the King until someone silenced them with a violent gesture. The figure in the mantle of stars lay huddled, one hand outflung, the mask awry. Lady Lavinia, to her credit, retained her presence of mind. She gestured imperiously to the footman, who lowered the curtains with a sweep. "Poirot!" I exclaimed. "The king! Murdered!" Poirot's hand closed upon my sleeve with surprising strength. "Not so fast, Hastings. The king or the man in the mantle of stars? Wait." We pressed forward with the throng, though Poirot, with his usual uncanny dexterity, contrived to move without seeming to jostle. A small group already surrounded the fallen man. Two of them I recognized as Foreign Office attachés. Another, a tall, fair fellow in evening dress, unmasked, knelt beside the victim and tore open the mantle. His hands were steady, businesslike. "A physician," Poirot murmured. "Bon,
we shall learn something." The man looked up presently. "Alive," he said curtly, "but only just. A wound, here." He indicated the side. "A blade, narrow. Whoever struck knew his work." There was an audible sigh from those nearest. Alive. Then the first rush of fear ebbed, and the questions began. Who had done it? Where had he gone? Had anyone seen the weapon? I, for one, had seen nothing but that trivial gesture with the tray. Yet in my mind's eye I could still picture the golden domino tapping his cane against his thigh. Poirot bent closer to me. "Describe him, Hastings." I did so as best I could. Poirot listened attentively, nodding once or twice. "And the footman, eh?" "Yes." He changed the tray from one hand to the other. Poirot gave a little grunt of satisfaction. "Details, mon ami, details. Always it is there that the truth resides. A domino who vanishes. A servant who serves with the wrong hand. A lady with the mask of the bat who withdraws discreetly at the stroke of midnight. Ah, we have already too many shadows. I do not like it." By now the Foreign Office men had lifted the injured monarch and were conveying him through a side door. Lady Lavinia, pale beneath her rouge, seized Poirot by the arm. "Monsieur Poirot, you saw? You understand the danger? If the papers get wind of this, if Scandia learns that an attempt has been made on His Majesty's life..." "They will learn it," Poirot said with decision. "It is better so. But first, the truth." He looked about him. The great hall was in confusion, but the panic was already settling into a murmur of conjecture. London society prides itself upon self-control, even when wearing a clown's cap. Already the cry was being repeated, "An accident, a feint, only a feint." Poirot drew himself up. "Lady Lavinia, the doors, they must be closed. Not one person must leave until the police arrive." "But, Monsieur Poirot..." "Madame, do not argue. Your fortune, your reputation, your king, they are all at stake. It is better to endure a little scandal now than to let the assassin slip through the door in a Pierrot's rags." Something in his tone quelled her. She gestured to the servants, who hurried to obey. Poirot turned to me. His eyes were bright, full of suppressed excitement. "Attend, Hastings. We must act quickly. There is a murderer in this room, or one who meant murder. And where does he hide? Among the Pierrots, the Columbines, the Pharaohs? We shall find him. We shall find him." "But how?" I asked. He touched his temple. "By using the head, Hastings. By asking the right question. For example, why should the assassin strike at the very moment of midnight?" "Well, because it was dramatic," I said. "Symbolic, you know." Poirot's moustaches bristled. "Symbolic, yes. But symbolism is the luxury of poets, not assassins. No, no. There was a reason for midnight, and we shall discover it." At that moment, a commotion broke out near the staircase. A woman's mask had been torn aside by a zealous footman. It was the bat-masked lady. She turned upon him furiously, her pale face flashing. "How dare you! I am Lady Constance Whitfield. My family shall hear of this outrage." She swept away, her cloak fluttering like dark wings, and the crowd parted before her. Poirot's eyes followed her thoughtfully. "Ah, Hastings, the bat takes flight, but in the end we shall net her. For the present we observe. The midnight mask has begun." Chapter 3. Behind the Masks. The great doors of Albemarle Hall had been locked, and the masqueraders, deprived of their escape, drifted uneasily in groups about the ballroom. Some affected laughter, some whispered urgently behind masks. One or two had already torn theirs off, as though anonymity itself were guilt. Poirot moved amongst them like a small black shadow of order in the confusion. His voice, low and courteous, drew answers where another man would have met resistance. I followed, not without a sense of drama. It was not the first time I had seen him take command of a roomful of people far his social superiors. and never had he seemed more assured. He halted near the staircase. "You observed Hastings, our friend the footman. Where is he now?" I looked. The line of liveried men who had stood like statues earlier had diminished by one. "Gone," I said. Poirot nodded. To vanish at such a moment, it is eloquent. A Foreign Office man, Major Densham, I think his name was, and approached us. "Monsieur Poirot, Lady Lavinia tells me you advise keeping the doors closed. The police are already on their way, but it may be some minutes before they arrive. In the meantime, what course do you suggest?" Poirot inclined his head. "We begin at once. There are three possibilities. One, the assassin is already far away, having escaped before the doors were closed. Two, he lies hidden among the guests. Three," Poirot's eyes narrowed, "the assassin wears still the mask of service and passes amongst us with a tray." Densham frowned. "You suggest one of the staff?" "I suggest nothing, I observe. Come, Hastings, we will interview the lady who was so eager to proclaim her identity." We found Lady Constance Whitfield in the anteroom, fanning herself furiously. Her bat mask lay discarded on a chair. She was pale and angry. "Monsieur Poirot, I will not be treated like a criminal. That idiot of a servant laid hands on me." Poirot bowed. "Forgive me, Lady Constance, but you chose a mask most sinister." "Why?" "Why, because it suited me. Is that a crime?" "Not in itself. Yet you withdrew into the shadow just as the clock struck." Her fan paused. "What of it?" "It was the precise moment chosen for the attempt. Did you see anything?" She hesitated, then, "A figure, tall, in gold." He brushed past me. I remember the gleam. "The golden domino," I breathed. "Precisely," Poirot murmured. "Merci, milady. You have been of service." As we withdrew, I said, "So it was the golden domino." Poirot shook his head. "Always you jump, Hastings. A golden flash, yes. But how easy to contrive. A strip of gilt paper, a touch of paint, et voila. One is remembered as the golden figure." "No, no. The assassin may count upon the eye to deceive." We passed again into the ballroom. Poirot's gaze swept the company, now gathered into anxious knots. The musicians huddled by their instruments, whispering. Columbines clutched their partners' arms. Henry VIII mopped his brow with regal indignation. Poirot raised his voice. "Mesdames et messieurs, one among you has committed a crime most grave. I beg you, remove your masks." There was a stir, a ripple of protest. Then, one by one, reluctantly, they obeyed. Painted faces emerged into the hard glare of the chandeliers, some defiant, some ashamed. It was oddly more grotesque to see the motley costumes with bare, strained faces above them. Yet one figure did not move. Near the door, a domino of black and silver leaned indolently against the panelling, his mask still in place. Poirot's eyes fastened upon him. "Monsieur, your mask." The figure did not stir. Then slowly, deliberately, he turned, and without a word slipped through the small side door near the musicians. There was a cry. Two or three gentlemen sprang after him. I was about to follow when Poirot's hand shot out. "No, Hastings, let them chase shadows. Come, we will look elsewhere."
"Elsewhere?"
"Yes. Where the truth hides, mon ami. Not in the masks, but in what lies beneath them." And with that, he guided me swiftly towards the servants' passage. Chapter 4. Below the Stairs. We passed from the splendour of the ballroom into the narrow service passage, the laughter and music behind us dying like a theatre heard through thick walls. Here the air was cooler, redolent of coal dust and polish, with that peculiar stillness of a place where the staff had been summoned above, and the heart of the house lay momentarily deserted. Poirot's patent leather shoes clicked briskly on the tiles. The truth, Hastings, he murmured. It waits for us here in the shadows. The world above is all masks and play. But below stairs, it is the world without disguise.
We came upon the servants gathered in a small hall near the kitchen, watched over by a stout butler whose dignity, I sensed, was sorely tried by events. The cook, flushed and indignant, sat upon a bench. Two young footmen whispered together, pale and shifty-eyed. A maid twisted her apron. They rose when Poirot entered, as though instinctively recognizing a figure of authority. Poirot bowed, smiling, and seated himself neatly at the table. "Monsieur Dame," he began gently, "a man has been struck down tonight. I ask only for the truth. One of you knows something." The butler drew himself up. "Sir, if I may, the staff of Lady Lavinia are loyal, respectable." Poirot lifted a hand. "May we, but among the loyal, the respectable, there may creep a serpent. Let us talk. One by one, if you please." First came the butler himself, Mr. Felton. He stood like a grenadier, chin high. "Sir, I know my staff. Not a one would stoop to murder. We've been with her ladyship through two seasons. She treats us well." Poirot studied him. "Yet one of your number is missing. A footman?" Felton's face darkened. "Parsons, sir. A new fellow. Taken on just last week. Said he'd come from a house in Bayswater. Good height, smart in livery, but I never trusted him."
"Why not?"
Poirot asked softly. The butler hesitated. "He had too much the air of a man who watches. A servant should melt into the background. Parsons was always listening, eyes everywhere." Poirot's glance sharpened. "Describe him." Felton obliged. Tall, fair, a scar near the temple, hands marked with old burns. Poirot nodded, committing it all to memory. "Merci, monsieur, you have the eye." Next came a parlour maid, Elsie by name, her voice trembling. "Please, sir, I didn't do nothing, only I saw him, Mr. Parsons. He was in the passage not 10 minutes before the clock struck, and he had... Oh, I don't know if I should..."
"Courage," Poirot encouraged. "Say it."
"He had changed his gloves, grey ones. I thought it queer, for the footmen wear white."
"Grey gloves?" I exclaimed.
Poirot silenced me with a look. "Très bien, mademoiselle. You have noticed what is important. Continue."
"That's all, sir."
Then the gong sounded, and he went up with the tray. Poirot leaned forward.
"The tray?
What tray?" "A glass, sir. A single glass with wine. I thought it odd, too, for the trays always carry at least four, but he said it was special, for a guest of honour." I felt a thrill. The pieces were fitting together, but Poirot's face betrayed only calm. Madame, for such she seemed, came next, wiping her hands on a cloth with indignation. "I know nothing, sir, only that the man Parsons was forever prying, asked what wines were kept, how they were served, who was to have the special dishes. Pah! I said to him, 'Attend to your own duties.'" Poirot inclined his head. "One last thing, madame. Tonight, when you prepared the service, was anything missing?" She frowned. "Now you mention it. Yes, a carving knife. Slim, sharp, with a steel handle. I scolded the boy for mislaying it, but it was not found." Poirot's eyes gleamed. "Ah, a knife that slips easily into a man's side without drawing notice. That is suggestive. Lastly, the two younger footmen, boys of scarcely 20, stepped forward nervously. They corroborated Elsie's tale. Parsons had spoken little, but his eyes were everywhere. One added, 'After the king fell, sir, I thought I saw Parsons slip down the musician's stair. But then, I'm not sure, all was confusion.'" Poirot thanked them gravely. When all had been heard, he dismissed the staff with a little bow. "Courage, mes enfants! Go now, but remain within call." When they had gone, I turned eagerly to Poirot. "It's clear as daylight. The false footman, Parsons, is our man. He brought the poisoned glass,
or perhaps stabbed the king with the missing knife. The grey gloves, they mark him as the Golden Domino. He has escaped.
Poirot tapped his fingers thoughtfully together.
Clear? To you, perhaps. To me, it is a picture still blurred.
Yes? He disguised himself as a servant.
Yes? He contrived a glass, a knife.
But reflect, Hastings, why the elaborate masquerade?
If he were already in the house as a guest, why change into livery? If he were only a servant, why draw attention by changing his gloves?
No, no. There is here something of the theatre,
a drama contrived to mislead.
But you admit he struck the blow?
Poirot shook his head.
I admit nothing. Consider the king was wounded, not killed. The blow was precise, yet spared the heart. And who is it that can strike thus, with delicacy?
A soldier, I suggested.
Perhaps, or a surgeon.
He rose abruptly. Come, Hastings, we return to the ballroom. I must speak again with Lady Constance, and also with the Foreign Office gentleman. There is more at play here than a lone assassin. There is conspiracy. As we retraced our steps, I could not resist muttering,
Well, if Parsons isn't the villain, then I'm a Dutchman.
Poirot smiled faintly.
It is always possible, mon ami. But let us not hang the Dutchman until the rope is strong enough to bear.
And with that enigmatic remark, we mounted the stairs back into the blaze of the mask, where suspicion and fear still twined like dancers, awaiting the last act of a drama. Chapter 5. The Unveiling. The ballroom had thinned. Guests stood in uneasy clusters, the masquerade quite forgotten, their finery incongruous under the glare of the chandeliers. Lady Lavinia, pale but resolute, had yielded a small withdrawing room for Poirot's inquiries. There, with a chair drawn up neatly, he presided as though it were a court of justice, while I hovered, notebook in hand.
"Let us proceed, Hastings," he said, his moustaches quivering with satisfaction. "One by one the masks will fall, not of silk or satin, but of the soul."
She swept in first, her cloak trailing like wings, her chin high. "Monsieur Poirot, I demand—" Poirot's hand lifted.
"You may demand later, madame, for now you shall answer. You wore the bat's mask. Why that choice?"
"It suited me, a mere whim."
"Ah, but the whim of society ladies is seldom mere," Poirot said gently. "You withdrew into the shadows at midnight. Why?"
"I was warm. I wished for air."
Poirot's eyes sharpened.
"At that same instant a man was struck. Et alors, you told us earlier that the Golden Domino brushed past you. Think again, Lady Constance. Was that truly what you saw?"
Her fan trembled.
"It was gold, yes, a glint. Perhaps I imagined it. The lights were dazzling."
"Precisely," Poirot murmured. "And you have debts, madame, large ones. Were you promised relief if you lent your presence to a small deception? For example, placing a note?"
Her composure cracked.
"A note?"
Poirot drew from his pocket the penciled warning we had received with Lady Lavinia's invitation. "This, madame." The hand that wrote it had theatrical flourish, the hand of one accustomed to play. "You, perhaps, or one of your companions." She stared at it, stricken.
"I never saw it before."
"But—" she faltered, then blurted out.
"I did see another, just after supper."
"Slipped beneath my cloak by some unknown hand. It said only, 'The bat shall fly at midnight,' I thought it a jest."
"Which you destroyed."
"Yes, I was afraid."
Poirot leaned back, his eyes like steel. "Lady Constance, you have concealed much that I do not forget."
The major entered with stiff dignity. He took the chair as though under court-martial.
"Monsieur Poirot, I trust this performance of yours will not delay the police. His Majesty's safety—"
Poirot interrupted with a polite wave.
"The police will come. But we, monsieur, we are already here. Tell me, you were close to the dais?"
"I was."
"And what did you see?"
"A movement in the crowd, a flash, gold, I think. Then the king staggered."
Poirot's moustaches bristled. "Gold again, convenient, n'est-ce pas? Almost too convenient. Tell me, Major,
Who had knowledge of Lady Lavinia's arrangements? The tableau, the hour, the dais?
The Foreign Office, naturally. We handled His Majesty's appearance.
And you, personally? The Major's jaw tightened.
Yes, I advised Her Ladyship.
Poirot's voice dropped.
Then you are in the position not only to see the crime, Major, but to arrange the stage upon which it was played.
The Major half rose, furious.
Sir?
Poirot only bowed.
Sit, Major, guilt shouts, innocence explains, you have done neither.
She entered next, a tragic figure in her queenly ruff.
Monsieur Poirot, this will ruin me.
Better ruin, madame, than murder unpunished.
Tell me, these notes. You received three?
Yes. Anonymous, all of them. They warned me that midnight would bring disaster. I thought them some ghastly jest.
Who had access to them before you opened them?
She hesitated.
Miss Lenoir, my maid. She brings the post.
Poirot's eyes gleamed.
Bon. Already we approach the heart. Tell me, madame, did any among your guests know of these threats?
No, only I.
And now you.
Poirot's tone was grave.
Then either the sender meant you to act, or else to be paralyzed by fear. You chose the latter. It is human, but it has cost us dearly.
Tears welled in her eyes.
I never thought.
No, but someone else thought very carefully indeed.
The doctor entered, pince-nez gleaming coldly.
The king lives, he announced, but the wound was calculated. A precise thrust, angled to collapse him without killing. It smacks of science.
Of science, Poirot echoed softly.
A curious word, doctor. Tell me, who attends the king most closely?
I do. He trusts me entirely.
And yet under your eyes he falls.
Dr. Penrose's lips thinned.
I cannot guard him from knives in the dark.
No.
Yet you admire the skill of the hand that struck.
To me that is curious. Did you perhaps receive one of these notes?
The doctor's composure flickered.
I know what notes.
Poirot's gaze pinned him.
So you knew nothing. Yet you grow pale when I mention them. Why is that?
Penrose said nothing, only rose abruptly and stalked out, his face bloodless.
When all had gone, I turned eagerly to Poirot.
Well, Poirot, the case is clear. The false footman, Parsons, he wrote the notes, wore the golden domino, and struck the king. Lady Constance saw him, the others confirm it. It all fits.
Poirot shook his head slowly.
No, Hastings, it does not fit. If the assassin meant to kill, he would not have missed. If he meant to terrify, why strike at all?
The notes speak of theatre, of revelation. We are in a drama, Hastings, and the curtain has not yet fallen.
He rose, his eyes glittering.
Come. It is time to gather all the players upon the stage. Before dawn, the truth shall be known.
Chapter 6. The Denouement. The chandeliers of Albemarle Hall still blazed, but the gaiety of an hour earlier had drained from the room. The guests, pale and restless, gathered once more beneath the painted balconies. Masks dangled forgotten in their hands. Laughter was replaced by whispers. At the dais, crimson drapery still bore a faint stain where the King of Scandia had fallen. Poirot stood at the centre, immaculate, his black domino cast aside. He held himself with the quiet assurance of one who already knows. I, notebook in hand, felt the thrill of anticipation.
Mesdames, messieurs, Poirot began, forgive that your revels are curtailed, but better so than that a murderer should walk free amongst you. Tonight an attempt was made, not upon a man alone, but upon the future of a nation.
A murmur swept the crowd. Poirot raised a hand.
From the beginning there were three things curious. First, the notes, anonymous, theatrical, warning that midnight would bring truth. Second, the wound itself, struck with precision, yet not fatal. And third, the disappearing footman. Let us examine.
He paced a little. A true assassin does not warn. He strikes and flees. Yet here, we are bombarded with threats. Do not let him strike 12. At midnight, the part he plays will be the last. These are not warnings. They are advertisement. The hand behind them wished the drama to be seen. His gaze swept the crowd. Then the wound, a thrust of the knife, controlled, sparing the heart. A surgeon's strike, not a killer's. The king falls, aye, bleeds, but he lives. Is it not extraordinary?
Are you suggesting, cried Lady Lavinia, that His Majesty was meant to survive?
Just so, madame. Which brings us to the footman. Parsons. A disguise, yes, but a disguise meant to be noticed. Grey gloves, a tray with a single glass. Details that draw the eye. A man who intends escape melts into the crowd. This one invited memory. Why? Because he is a phantom, created to be blamed.
There was a stir, anxious glances exchanged. Poirot's voice rang out, clear and merciless.
The truth is this. The King of Scandia was never in mortal danger. The wound was designed, by one with medical skill, to alarm, to make him appear a target, a martyr. Why? Because a monarch menaced abroad wins sympathy at home. His enemies in Scandia cry tyrant, but now they must cry victim. London society reels with shock. The English government vows protection, and His Majesty returns to his throne with strengthened power. A gasp ran through the company. Poirot's finger darted out like a rapier.
And who arranged the stage? Who advised Lady Lavinia of the midnight tableau, knowing every detail of the setting? Who is trusted to be always near the king's person, with the knowledge to wound without killing?
Monsieur, it was no foreign anarchist. It was contrived by his own circle. Major Densham, you arranged the mask. Dr. Penrose, you struck the blow.
All eyes turned. The major half rose, furious. This is preposterous. Poirot's eyes glittered.
Preposterous? No, political. Major, you play your part. The stage, the distraction, the convenient golden flash to occupy witnesses. But the true hand, is the doctor's. Only he could be sure the king would live, to return to his people a wounded hero. Voila, the plot, as delicate as surgery, as theatrical as your mask.
Dr. Penrose had gone deathly pale.
You cannot prove...
Poirot's hand shot up.
But I can. The missing carving knife, taken from below stairs, is of your choosing. Slim, sharp, like a surgeon's scalpel. And this...
he produced a folded slip of paper.
"Was found in your pocketbook when you leaned over the king. One of the notes, still smudged with candle wax. You were careless, Monsieur Docteur. You thought to terrify Lady Lavinia with them, to complete the play, but you left your prop behind."
A collective intake of breath shook the room. The doctor's lips moved soundlessly, then he covered his face with his hands.
"For Scandia," he muttered. "Only for Scandia. He must have their love, or he is lost."
Poirot inclined his head gravely.
"Ah, so, for Scandia. Always, Hastings, the great crimes are justified, in the name of love, of country, of duty. Yet they are crimes all the same."
Two constables, newly arrived, took the physician by the arms. Lady Lavinia sank into a chair, trembling. The guests whispered aghast.
Poirot smoothed his moustaches.
"And so, mes amis, the mask is ended. The truth is unmasked. Politics has claimed the theatre tonight. But justice, too, has had its bow."
He turned to me, eyes twinkling despite the solemnity. "Come, Hastings, this has been a long night. We will leave kings and conspiracies to their fate. For myself... I desire only a tisane and the perfection of my pillows."
And so ended the Mask of Albemarle Hall. Not in revelry, but in revelation.
Epilogue: A Quiet Morning. It was nearly 7 when we returned to Whitehaven Mansions. London was waking, the milk carts rattling and a thin mist rising from the river.
To step from the fever of Albemarle Hall into the quiet of our sitting room was like waking from a dream. Poirot, fastidious as ever despite the hour, brushed a speck of gilt confetti from his sleeve with distaste. So unnecessary, Hastings. Gold paper in the hair. The confetti, it offends me. It clings where it should not. Murder, too, is like that. I sank into a chair, weary to the bone. But what a case, Poirot! To think it was all contrived, the wound, the notes, even the vanishing footman, a plot to make a king more popular. Poirot nodded gravely. Yes, mon ami, the theatre of politics. One cannot underestimate its stagecraft. A king with enemies may win more by bleeding in another land than by speaking 100 speeches at home.
And the doctor?
He will not hang, said Poirot quietly. Too valuable to Scandia. The matter will be hushed. Perhaps an exile, perhaps a sanitarium. Politics will arrange it. But the truth, the truth remains. And it was my task to reveal it. I was silent, remembering Lady Lavinia's ashen face, Lady Constance's trembling hands, the bewilderment of guests who had thought themselves at a party and found themselves in a drama of kings. Poirot broke into my thoughts with a little sigh. Such extravagance, Hastings. All that masquerade, only to arrive at the inevitable. I prefer symmetry. The little grey cells, they bring order to disorder, and now order is restored. He folded his hands neatly. There will be headlines, naturally. Foreign king menaced in Mayfair mask. The public will be thrilled. But between ourselves, Hastings, it was a poor attempt at deception. Too much glitter, not enough finesse. I laughed. I suppose you prefer your conspiracies tidy. No confetti, no bat masks, no golden dominoes. Exactamente. Give me a straightforward murder in the drawing room, with a proper fire and comfortable chairs. That, at least, has style. He rose, smoothing his tie. And now, mon ami, bed. For kings and conspiracies do not alter the fact that Hercule Poirot must have his rest. Come. Already the sun rises. The world continues. And that, Hastings, is perhaps the greatest theatre of all. And with that he retired, leaving me to wonder, not for the first time, how it was that in the strangest corners of life, Poirot always contrived to find the neatest ending. And so concludes A Royal Masquerade. From masks and confetti to the quiet of dawn, the case has been revealed. If you've listened until the final word, you are part of what keeps these mysteries alive. Share in the comments where you're listening from and let us know what part of the mask captured your imagination. Creating each story, from the first line on the page to the last word you hear, takes many hours of care. If you'd like to support the work, you can join our membership for ad-free access and exclusive content, or leave a tip. And even if you cannot contribute today, your time, your comments, and the simple act of listening already carry Poirot's cases and Hastings' voice farther than we could alone. Until our next tale, good night.